This afternoon, I'd like to talk about some of the challenging states of mind or challenging energies that come up in our practice. The ones that we all of us, get caught in and struggle with. And the Buddha actually particularly highlighted a set of these difficult states. And so I think the fact that he highlighted this set of states of mind indicates, you know, these are very human struggles. They've been human struggles for at least 2,600 years, probably way longer than that. So the five mental energies or patterns that unsettle our mind, he called the five hindrances, and they are sense desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and anxiety, or restlessness and agitation, and doubt. Any of you experience any of these in the last 2 days? Yeah. It's like this. It's like this. And the Buddha called them hindrances, the term hindrances, because they tend to get in the way, or they tend to be the energies that are what are masking or getting in the way of our ability to have the mind settle down, or the mind to be concentrated. And yet, even as he called them hindrances, he said, we can be mindful of them. In his instructions on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, he had a whole section on working with the hindrances. So clearly, they're not something that we have to get rid of in order to meditate. In fact, we can use them as the compost. I think compost is a good analogy. Use them as the compost out of which we can really cultivate our hearts and our minds. So the shift, and really what we have to look at is often our relationship to these difficult energies. Again, sense desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and agitation and doubt. Often our relationship to them is either we think that they're a problem and that they're in the way of our practice. We have to get rid of them in order to get on with practice. Or we may somehow believe that they're important, you know, that the sense desire is something we need to follow through on, or that our doubt is something we need to figure out. And so in some way we buy into these energies, either with a kind of a believing them, or a sense that they're a problem. Both of these relationships keep us kind of caught or stuck in these energies. And so the crucial shift that we've been talking about with mindfulness, bringing this curious mindfulness to our experience, means that we shift our relationship around these hindrances from believing they're a problem or buying into them, thinking that we have to act on them or do something with them, to being curious, what is this experience? What is sense desire? What is ill will anyway? What's the experience of sloth and torpor? So we shift to a curiosity, a curious mindfulness. And that very shift changes the hindrance from being something in the way of concentration, from being the very experience around which concentration can develop. It changes the hindrance from being in the way of the path of practice to being the path of practice. And so learning about that shift, learning to recognize these hindrances as hindrances, learning to recognize these states of mind, and then shifting to that curiosity completely transforms how they function in our minds, completely transforms them and makes them, it turns them into that compost. It turns them into, you know, compost has that quality of starting out as garbage and turning into great soil. And kind of similarly, the hindrances start out as something that's in the way, something that's not so useful, apparently not so useful, and yet the changing our relationship or being curious about the hindrances turns them into the soil through which wisdom can grow, through which insight can be developed and cultivated. So these hindrances are states of mind that I would say are usually experienced as dukkha, as stress, as suffering, the first noble truth that Annie spoke about last night. So the hindrances are usually experienced as that. Often we have the sense of not being satisfied with what's happening. And with sense desire, there's a sense of we want something that's not here. With ill will, we have the sense of not wanting something that is here. With sloth and torpor, there's the feeling of dullness or thickness of mind, a sense that the mind isn't really able to connect to experience. With restlessness, the sense of mind is all over the place. And doubt, the sense that we're confused about what to do or not certain about how to engage with the practice or feeling like that we don't know that we have the capacity to engage with the practice. And so there's always with these states of mind, there's a sense of something's off or something's wrong or it just doesn't feel at ease. The mind does not feel at ease. The mind does not feel peaceful. And so looking at what the Buddha suggested we do with dukkha, again from Annie's talk on the Four Noble Truths, he said, dukkha should be understood. And so this is that shift. Something's arising in our minds. Sense desire, ill will arising in our minds. Experienced as something off, as not restful, not peaceful, not at ease. Can we turn our attention to understand that state? Understanding here meaning not figuring it out with our thoughts, but understanding it through our actual experience. Understanding what is this experience of sense desire. Ajahn Sumedho uses a phrase that is a great encapsulation of this shift of mind. Sense desire is like this. Ill will is like this. Just shifting our relationship from being one of feeling like it needs to be fixed or changed to curiosity. And what is this experience? Now, this is the understanding that the Buddha is pointing to. This understanding from the inside. Understanding the experience. Not understanding, like, you know, sometimes when we think of the word understanding, we might think about what we think about, like, why is this happening right now? Well, I guess it's happening because when I was a kid, I was always the one left out on the playground, and I was always the one that didn't have friends, and I was very lonely, and we think about things that way. You know, we tell the story of why we're having this issue. That's not what the Buddha meant by understanding. By understanding, he meant, what is the direct experience here and now? Understanding through experience, not through thoughts or concept. One way that I like to think about this understanding or this exploration from the inside is it's like we're naturalists. We are exploring nature. And that's what we are. We are exploring the nature of our minds. We're exploring the nature of our emotions. We're exploring the nature of our struggle, of our suffering. We're exploring the nature of our bodies. And so we are exploring nature. And much as a naturalist in nature goes out and observes, at least some kinds of naturalists, you know, some kinds of naturalists go out there and cut things down and put them in machines and try to pull them apart and figure out what they are and how many cells they have in them and all that kind of thing. But some naturalists go out there and just observe. They sit quietly in nature and watch. This kind of observation is a slower process of understanding, but it reveals the changing patterns through just witnessing, through watching over and over again. And very similarly, as we watch and observe these challenging energies in our mind, we learn about the patterns. We learn what the experience is. We learn the conditions that set it into motion. We learn what it is to not have it be there. So, reflecting on being a naturalist with our experience. And this is a really good analogy for exploring and understanding. So I'd like to talk about each of these five energies. So the first is sense desire. And this is, sense desire is the desire to experience pleasant sense experience. My understanding is this is primarily about the five physical senses, so to experience pleasant sights, sounds, smells, taste, touch. This is about the desire to experience these. The out of balance or the out of kilter part around sense desire is that we are kind of driven by a need to have that sense pleasure because we think that is where happiness will come from. We think that it will not be possible to have happiness unless we can get what we want. This is a foundational confusion in our minds. That we think happiness comes from getting what we want. We've had so many experiences where that has proven to be true in our lives, that we have gotten what we wanted and there was a little bit of happiness there. The Buddha doesn't deny actually that that happens. He says, yes, when desire gets what it wants, there is a form of happiness. And he said, and how long does that happiness last? You know, what is the actual happiness there? It's pretty fleeting. When we get what we want, we have a little bit of happiness of having that thing. And then the thing changes or shifts or, you know, if you see something simple like chocolate, you know, it comes and goes pretty quickly. Although on a recent retreat, it was quite interested to see just how long the happiness of chocolate lasted. I was exploring this, you know. This was a month-long retreat, and people occasionally brought chocolate and put it out there, and I would take a bit of chocolate, and I would pick my time, you know, sit there, open my chocolate, put it in my mouth, and I like to let my chocolate melt, so you know, I'm a melter rather than a chewer. And so it was, you know, being present, and this is another piece I want to get to, being present for that, there was a lot of pleasure associated with that chocolate. It was very pleasant. It was quite nice. And actually it lasted, you know, the chocolate dissolved and the feeling, the good feeling associated with the chocolate lasted at least 5 minutes past the chocolate disappearing in the mouth. I was quite surprised. It's like, yeah, that was pretty good. That was pretty nice. So, you know, but it disappears. It does disappear. And so everything, you know, everything, as Annie was saying yesterday, everything is impermanent. And so anything that we are relying on as a place of happiness, any pleasant experience that we think, yes, this is happiness, it's going to disappear. And so what we end up on is kind of a cycle. It's like, well, that one disappeared. Well, where's the next one? And we start looking for where I can have the next bit of happiness. Where can I find the next little bit of pleasure? And because we've seen in our lives that we've gotten happiness from getting what we want, and that's pretty much been the only way we've noticed happiness, is we think that's the only way to have happiness. And what the Buddha suggests and what the exploration around sense desire is to watch the desire itself. You know, when we actually start looking at the experience of sense desire, we see that what's going on is there's a kind of a delusion in the mind. There's a leaping forward in the mind to, you know, when I get that thing, I'm going to be happy. And so the mind is kind of projecting into the future. I'm going to get that thing and I'm going to be happy when I get that thing. And in the process of that projection into the future, the mind is not seeing that in this moment, this kind of leaning forward, this pulling towards, this feeling of I need that thing in order to be happy is already a feeling of dissatisfaction. It's already a feeling of out of balance, of unease. So our mind has, you know, confused us into thinking we are going to be happy, but we're giving up happiness now for the idea of happiness even a few seconds from now. And so as we turn towards the feeling of desire, of wanting that thing to make me happy, we feel that kind of out of balance feeling. We feel that pull. We feel that sense of, oh, you know, as soon as desire springs up in the mind, as soon as sense desire springs up in the mind, if I want that thing, that's what's going to make me feel good. As soon as that desire springs up, there's already a feeling of lack of ease. Already there is dissatisfaction. And so the Buddha's suggestion is, with respect to sense desire, understand sense desire. See if you can let go of the thing that you want. Let go of attending to the thing that we want. What I mean, where that mind projecting forward into the future is kind of like the mind is landing on that thing, like that new car or that nice piece of clothing or whatever it is that we want. You know, it's projecting into that and it's thinking it's going to be so great when I get that. And we're not seeing the feeling of the sense desire itself. And so if we can turn our attention out of the thing that we want to the feeling of desire itself, we will feel the unsatisfactory nature of desire. We'll feel that pull, that sense of unsatisfactoriness. And if we can watch that, fortunately, as with all things, it too is impermanent, and it will fade, it will pass. If you can actually watch sense desire until it goes away, you will be able to see, experience a different kind of happiness. The happiness comes from dissatisfaction being released rather than the acquisition of something. That feeling of the mind letting go of desire, of letting go of that wanting to have something, feels like you've been released from a vice grip. That kind of happiness isn't dependent on having something. It just comes from the letting go. So this exploration is about curiosity about what is sense desire about. So that turning the attention away from the thing we want to the feeling of desire itself, exploring it, getting to know it. In my own experience, it kind of feels like a magnetic pull to whatever it is that I want. And so there's that kind of a, somebody, when I described it that way, somebody said, oh, it's like the tractor beam in Star Trek, you know, it's like lock on and pull it to you. It's that kind of feeling of having this attachment like that. It's not the difficulty around sense desire is not the pleasant thing itself. It's not even having pleasant experience. It's that out of balance feeling that comes from wanting it. So, you know, I think it was yesterday Annie was talking, or maybe it was this morning, I don't remember, sometime Annie was talking about the kind of pleasantness that comes when we are just fully present. You know, when we're not wanting anything in particular, we are just open to experience. Very simple sense pleasure, very simple sense experience can bring a great deal of pleasure. You're really present for tofu with that sauce. And it's like, wow, I've never had tofu like this before. So the presence of mind without that leaning, just the availability to be present for experience, can create very lovely experiences of sense pleasure. But that's not the kind of pleasure that we are. It's not that we're not grasping after it. It's more that we're available for its arising. We're sitting here in the hall and we hear the sound of a bird. Just the delight and joy of that experience. That's not a problem. The problem is this out of kilter, this out of balance feeling of needing to have something. The second, ill will, has a kind of similar exploration to it. It sounds very different on the surface of it, but it's, you know, it's got the same kind of quality of, you know, with sense desire, there's something pleasant, and we're leaning after it in order to hold on to it. And so there's that leaning towards to have something. So it's a wanting to have. And in ill will, there's something unpleasant in our experience. And the relationship to that is like, how can I get rid of this? So it's a wanting to remove. So it has a kind of similar quality of wanting, but instead of wanting to keep, it's a wanting to get rid of. So this also has a delusion around it. The sense desire has the delusion that happiness will come if I can have what I want, that's where happiness will come from. And as I said, yes, there is a happiness from that, but the Buddha pointed out it's a lesser kind of happiness, that the happiness of the release of the wanting itself is ultimately more satisfying. And actually, if you look at this, if you watch this in your own experience, when you get what you want, you get a double hit of pleasure because you get the happiness of having the thing, and you also get the happiness of the ending of the wanting. And actually, that's the greater of the two happinesses. And you can have that. That can happen without the having. And so likewise with ill will, we have this confusion in our minds. We think that when there's unpleasant things in our environment, happiness will come from getting rid of those unpleasant things. And some of us have, you know, kind of orientations one way or the other. Some of us have a mind that gravitates, you know, we walk into a room and we gravitate towards, oh, I like that, and oh, look at that, and oh, I'd like to take that home with me. And others of us would walk into a room and say, oh, I don't like that, we should get rid of that, that needs to be fixed, that needs to be changed, look at that spot on the wall, that needs to be cleaned up. some minds orient more towards what we don't like, and some minds orient more towards what we like. But in both cases, there is this belief that the control of the environment, in one case getting rid of what I want, in one case holding on, keeping what I want, that happiness will come from that. And so this the delusion or confusion around ill will is that I will only be happy if I can get rid of these unpleasant experiences. And certainly, and that was my main orientation to life. It's like I walked into a room, I noticed experience, and actually at one point one teacher asked me to just notice what was obvious in my experience, not directing my attention, just sit there and notice what's obvious. And after a few minutes of doing that, you know, just, okay, that notice that, what's obvious there, and the next thing, what's obvious there, I noticed, you know, for about 2 or 3 minutes, I was just noticing what was obvious in my experience. And he said, well, how was that? I said, well, it was all unpleasant. Everything I noticed was unpleasant. It couldn't have possibly been just a random sampling. I mean, I know that there's got to be some, like, pleasant and neutral things out there, but my mind is zeroed in on the unpleasant. And this is another part of the confusion or the way these tendencies work in our mind. In my own mind, this orientation towards ill will meant that I walked into a room expecting to find things I didn't like. And lo and behold, I found things I didn't like. Wow. So this orientation is both a, you know, we think, oh, I need to get rid of these things. And yet it's a trap, because as I discovered for myself, you know, it's like the whole pattern of, oh, if I can only get rid of these unpleasant things, then I'll be okay, then I'll be happy. And I could go around, I'll take care of that one, and okay, a little bit of happiness there, and I'll take care of that one, and under control there, a little bit of happiness there, and well, let's take care of that one, and okay, good. And then, anything else? Yep. There's more unpleasant things, got to take care of them. So, you know, that whole orientation feeds on itself. So it's a trap. It's a trap. So the instruction, again, the instruction is to see if we can let go of the attention to the things that we find unpleasant and turn towards the experience of wanting to get rid of. That experience of ill will, that experience of aversion, of pushing away. What is this experience? This kind of, don't want that. All of these, both with wanting, with sense desire, and with ill will, a really helpful tool is to check into the body. You notice it's a mental quality, the wanting, the ill will, they're mental experiences, and yet they often manifest in the body. The sense of being drawn towards something we want, the sense of pushing away or contraction often with ill will, sense of tightening down, of pressing down. Noticing these experiences in our body can help us to be present for them. Be present for that experience itself. And again, to see that when we can be present for the ill will, present for the aversion, we see that it is impermanent. When we've taken our attention out of the thing we don't like, essentially the aversion is feeding itself off of unskillful, unwise attention to the things we don't like. And when we take our attention out of things we don't like and turn towards the feeling of ill will itself, the ill will is no longer being nourished, no longer being fed by that, oh, there's that thing, I've got to get rid of it, I got to fix it, I got to change it. That's feeding the ill will. Instead, we turn towards the experience of ill will. What is this experience? Tightness, contraction, pressure, tension. Some thoughts running in the mind. Okay, can I let go of those thoughts and just be with the experience? What are we nourishing here? We're nourishing mindfulness. We're nourishing investigation, curiosity. We're nourishing energy. We're nourishing wholesome qualities of mind. So it's changed. This is that shift from being involved in to curious mindfulness, changing that experience from something that's in the way of the deepening of our practice to the very thing that deepens our practice. So with both sense desire and ill will, there can be times when the power of that hindrance is stronger than our ability to be mindful of it. That, you know, sometimes we have gotten into a particularly fraught or charged situation where anger is very strong. I mean, ill will runs the range from mild dislike to severe hatred, rage. Likewise, sense desire has a range from just simple kind of liking to feeling like it's not okay unless I have that thing, that really strong sense of neediness around something. And so there will be times when we find that the power of the hindrance is stronger than our capacity to meet it with mindfulness. And this takes some discernment. If you can be mindful, if you can take your attention out of the thing you are either averse to or wanting and turn towards the experience of sense desire itself, that is almost always a helpful strategy. If it's difficult or if you see that turning your attention towards that state of mind, that feeling of anger or frustration or the neediness, if turning your attention towards it just kind of takes you back into a loop and you find yourself like just sucked into the vortex or pulled into the rabbit hole of that state of mind, it's often helpful to have a simple strategy of letting go of, so recognizing when we're overwhelmed by a state of mind and seeing if we can kind of change the channel. It's not about repressing that difficult state. For me, it was kind of more like I practiced this for a long period of time around a certain anger that I had, anger at a particular person. And whenever I noticed a thought of that person come into my mind, for a while I was trying to be mindful of it, but I would just find myself sucked right into the anger. And I decided after a certain point, you know, this isn't helpful. It's not helping me to try to be mindful of this state because my mindfulness doesn't seem to be strong enough to meet that. It's like the anger was like a tsunami and my mindfulness was like this little trickle. So the anger was just swamping any capacity for mindfulness, and so it would get pulled into the anger. And so I quickly recognized it's not so helpful to try to be mindful of that experience. And I would gently acknowledge it. I would recognize, I actually made a bargain with it. I said, I see you. I see that you're really important. You're asking for attention. And I like bowed to it, you know. And I can't pay attention to you right now. So I'm not going to stop you, but, you know, you do your thing. You can sit over there and you do your thing. And I'm going to put my attention on my feet. I was often walking when this anger came up. So just put my attention on my feet. And something neutral, I find actually a really helpful channel changer. You know, you want to change the channel from something really challenging. Find something neutral you can let your attention rest in. So when there is overwhelm around some of these difficult states, it's helpful to be able to recognize that and definitely you don't need to feel like it's a failure. It's just like, okay, not now. Another time, I made a bargain with it. I said, I'll pay attention to you and my mindfulness is stronger. And then changed the channel. I did that for several years around that anger. And actually, it had a huge impact. It just really allowed it to wear away by not engaging with it. It made it way weaker. So even that strategy of recognize and set aside, recognize and set aside, can be extremely powerful. So the third hindrance, sloth and torpor. A lot of you have talked about this, you know, the first couple days of retreat. There's often a sleepiness, a dullness. Sloth and torpor are those states of mind. Sleepiness, thick mind, low energy, that kind of thing. It can feel very difficult to be mindful in those kinds of states because the energy is low. And so, again, there needs to be a little bit of discernment here. But the first thing I'm going to explore with you is what it might mean to actually turn towards the experience of sloth and torpor itself. We talked about this a little bit with sleepiness. Actually being with meeting sleepiness, meeting that experience. What often is happening around sleepiness or dullness of mind is that we have an agenda in our mind, we have an idea in our mind of what we want to be paying attention to. So what being mindful means, I've picked my touchstone and it's the breath or it's hearing, and there's a lot of dullness in the mind and you can barely feel the breath at all. And so what does the mind do? It says, well, I can't meditate. I can't meditate while I've got this state of mind going. So might as well forget it, or we struggle with it and we, you know, we fight with it. And so I'd like to suggest to you, just hold this as a possibility, if you have enough presence of mind to say to yourself, I'm too tired or dull or sleepy to meditate, that you have enough mindfulness to be aware of the tiredness or dullness or sleepiness. So if you find yourself thinking that thought, check it out. See if you can be aware of the experience of dullness or tiredness or sleepiness itself. I like to explore this with an analogy. Mindfulness, awareness, the mind knowing things. It's kind of like there's this reflecting capacity in our mind. It reflects things, like a mirror reflects things. And it reflects things that are pleasant. It reflects things that are unpleasant. It doesn't matter what it's reflecting. The reflecting capacity of the mirror is not changed by what it reflects. And so very similarly, the capacity of the mind to know what's happening in the present moment has that kind of reflecting quality. It can simply know, oh, this is anger. This is wanting. This is unpleasant sensation, this is pleasant sensation. This is the breath. That mindfulness isn't, that reflecting capacity of mindfulness isn't impacted by what it reflects or what it knows. It's just that knowing. It just reflects. And now let's go back to the mirror and using the analogy, think about a time when you've been taking a hot shower and that mirror is coated with steam. So that mirror is not particularly reflecting the things in the room. You know, it's got you look at yourself in the mirror and you can see this fuzzy outline, right? That's kind of the way it feels when our mind is dull, right? You're trying to pay attention to something. It's like this fuzziness. It's like fog, you know, hard to touch things. It's just like this fog or this dullness of mind. But what we know about mirrors is that mirror, it's not that the mirror isn't doing its job. In fact, the mirror is doing its job perfectly. It's reflecting every drop of water on the mirror. And likewise, when our mind is dull or sleepy, well, let me finish the analogy a little bit. So, you know, it's so the mirror is reflecting the water, the droplets on the glass. So it's doing its job perfectly. And yet we're standing in front of the mirror trying to see our reflection. And the mirror is not doing the job we want it to do. It's not reflecting us in the way we want it to. And so we take something, you know, we wipe it down or something. And likewise, with our dull or sleepy mind, what's often going on is that we have some agenda of what we want to be paying attention to, and it's not dullness of mind. We don't want to be paying attention to dullness of mind, and yet that's the most it's the most obvious thing in that moment. When the mind is dull or low energy or tired, the most easy thing for that mindfulness to know is that dullness, that low energy, that tiredness itself. Check it out. When there is a low energy state, rather than trying to be with the breath, what is it like to be with low energy? It's not got that sharp, crisp kind of knowing, but it also can be quite clear. Yeah, this is dullness. Fogginess, this is what fogginess is like. So that shift of curiosity of what is this state, again, as opposed to trying to figure out how can I get rid of it? How can I fix it or change it? That's the first exploration around low energy. And I'd encourage you to try it. Play with it. See what happens for you. This has been transformative for my practice to play with this. And actually, it has helped my mindfulness, or helped me to have the mindfulness begin to touch into new or states of mind that I could never have imagined were possible to be mindful of. Anytime you have an idea or a belief, I can't be mindful while this state of mind is happening, question it and see how might it be, rather ask the question, how might it be possible to be mindful while this is happening? And there are times when, again, the hindrance is stronger than our capacity to be mindful, and there are times for taking action, opening the eyes, standing up, doing some walking meditation. These are very helpful strategies to raise the energy in the mind, to bring a little bit of energy. One really helpful one, if you're really sleepy, my teacher in Burma suggested, try walking backwards. That will wake you up. The fourth is restlessness and agitation. This one is got two sides to it. It's got a restlessness of body, which some of you have described. It's to me, it kind of feels like there's jumping beans under the skin. You know, it's like just this physical agitating, can't sit still in your seat kind of restlessness, physically very unpleasant. And then there is the mind that's agitated, the mind that feels like it can't settle down and it's just jumping all over the place, the mind that's kind of spinning off into thought all over the place. So for physical restlessness, it really helps to not resist the physical restlessness, but also one of the keys I found for physical restlessness was my mind tended to kind of go, okay, I'm supposed to be present for this physical restlessness, so where is it? And I would get out the microscope and try to be with the little tiny jumpy sensations in the body. That seemed to make it worse. And so another strategy is just like, that's almost like putting in a pressure cooker. You know, it's like, okay, where is that physical restlessness? Let me find it. And another strategy is, just allow that sense of restlessness to get as big as the room. When I first heard that, that kind of scared me. It's like, isn't that going to like make it worse? But what it actually seems to do is it gives it more space. it's like, you know, when you do this to that restlessness, it's like there's only this little space and all these jumping beans are like trying to move. And then when you give it this space, it's like there's a lot more space for that energy to be contained in. So just the idea of allowing a bigger space can really be helpful. Also really helpful to notice what your relationship to the physical restlessness is. It can come with ill will. You have the physical restlessness and we don't like it. We want to get rid of it. We want to fix it, change it. It tends to be an unpleasant experience, and so we may have the hindrance of ill will joined with the hindrance of restlessness, of physical restlessness. And so notice that. Sometimes it can be really helpful to simply recognize, yes, there is this unpleasant sensation and I don't like it. Again, bringing that attitude or relationship of not liking into consciousness where it has a chance to be known, as opposed to when it's in the unconscious field, that state of not liking, that state of ill will is kind of driving us. It's, you know, that state that was kind of what was making me go, okay, I'm going to figure this out, was a state of ill will towards that restlessness. And so that ill will was in control, saying, I'm going to figure this out, I'm going to get rid of it. And when I could, you know, if you can recognize, okay, here's this state of restlessness and not liking is happening, there's the opportunity to let go of being controlled by that relationship, by that not liking. The mental restlessness, the restless mind spinning, often there is a emotion connected with the restless mind. Some kind of an emotion, anxiety, worry, regret, self-recrimination. And so if you can recognize, you know, so if you've got that kind of restless mind going, see if you can recognize what's the emotion underneath. You could just check in, ask yourself, is there an emotion here? And sometimes that may open you to see, yes, oh, there is anxiety, or there is a feeling of regret happening. Annie talked about working with emotions this morning. Really helpful to, first of all, recognize that it's there. When we recognize an emotion that is fueling a restless thought pattern, very often that emotion is basically asking for attention. It's kind of almost like the restless thoughts are kind of the emotion kind of sending up flares. Hey, I'm here, pay attention to me. Pay attention to me. So the allowing or opening to the emotion, the emotion is getting its attention and it can stop sending up all of that restless energy in the mind. And so it can help us to ground our attention in the body. What is that emotion? Sometimes there may be a restlessness that doesn't feel like it's connected to a particular emotion. It just feels like this energy, like this really high energy. And sometimes the way I work with that, it's almost like, it almost feels like that energy is a wild horse. And can I jump on that wild horse and just ride the wild horse? It's very similar in a way to the relationship to sloth and torpor. Rather than trying to resist it or fix it or change it, what is the experience of this energy? What is that sense of being on that wild horse, if you can be aware of it? One time it was strong enough, the image was that I was riding a whale. It had that much power to it, feeling like I was just being dragged, but I was completely aware of it. And it was a pretty powerful energy. It actually lasted for, about 45 minutes, but I could tell that it was just living its life. So, you know, just opening to that energy, catching the wave, riding the wave of that energy. And again, it's helpful to know when it's not possible to be mindful of this energy. with all of these hindrances, really helpful to have that discernment about when our mindfulness is not strong enough to meet the energy. And so if you see that trying to be mindful of that energy or of that emotion just makes it worse or takes you into the vortex of that, takes you deeper into the rabbit hole, go outside. And with a restless mind, nature can be a really great help. Just being in the redwoods. Redwoods are fantastic for stillness. You know, they have that really kind of quiet energy. And so just hanging out with the tree. At one point, I was seeing that. I was at Spirit Rock, and I actually went up into the hills, and I saw this one tree, and just, it's kind of like, I felt all this energy, and I felt like the tree, it was the strangest thing, actually. I'm not much of one for, like, communing with things. But I just saw this tree, and I felt like the tree was saying, I'll take it. And I just stood there, and just, like, I just felt like the tree was just willingly absorbing that energy. And so you may have, being in nature can be really helpful with this restless mind. The fifth difficult energy, again, just to remind you, when we make this shift to curiosity around these hindrances, they're no longer hindrances. They become the path. They become how we wake up. They become, anything can teach us the lessons of impermanence, unreliability, out of control. Anything, any experience can teach us those lessons, including self-hatred, including restless mind. So this shift towards curiosity, it both allows the mind to settle and be present, have a kind of continuity of presence for experience, which cultivates concentration and helps us to understand our minds. So the fifth of the hindrances is doubt. There are different kinds of doubt. There's doubt in the teachings. You know, we may feel, you know, the Buddha taught 2,600 years ago, you know, how can he know the challenges of our day and age with all of these devices we have and, you know, the massive scale of war and the kind of weapons we have? How can he possibly have anything to say to us? So there may be doubt in the teachings themselves. There could be doubt in the teachers, you know, what do these teachers know? And there can be doubt in ourselves. This one, I think doubt in ourselves, in our own capacity, is one of the most common and pervasive kinds of states in our meditation practice. Doubt is a particularly insidious hindrance because it can sound so rational. These teachers, they've just been practicing for 25 years or 10 years, whatever, you know, and what could they know? Or, you know, I need to go with that other teacher, that one that's been practicing for 40 years. If I practiced with that teacher, surely I would get enlightened. And so it sounds kind of rational, you know. Or, you know, doubt in ourselves. This isn't the right practice for me. You know, clearly, I can't do this practice. This was the first time I met mindfulness. I was reading a book on mindfulness, and I read the book at night and thought, this sounds great. I'll try this tomorrow. And the next time I remembered was when I picked up the book the next night. I thought, oh, I didn't remember. Well, I'll try again tomorrow. And after 3 or 4 days of that, basically gave up. Obviously, I can't do this. And it was another 15 years before I met mindfulness. So, you know, that, it was obvious to me. this practice, I mean, sounds good on paper, but obviously it's not for me. So doubt can have this quality of sounding very reasonable. So it's very believable. So we need to learn to recognize doubt by the stories it's telling us and begin to question those stories. So doubt, often this kind of doubt, I mean, we can have the kind of doubt that's the hindrance to practice is doubt in the practice, doubt in the teachings, doubt in ourselves to do the practice. It's not necessarily doubt around, like, can I go skydiving? You know, that's not what we're talking about here. So this kind of doubt often manifests as thoughts about the practice. So if you find yourself thinking about the practice, I can't do this practice. This practice isn't for me. What good is this? How can this possibly help? I should do another practice. What did the Buddha know? What do these teachers know? If you find yourself thinking along those lines, if those kinds of thoughts are coming up, check in. What else is happening here? It's probably a form of doubt. And often there is some kind of underlying feeling associated with doubt too. It's not just about the thoughts. There's usually a feeling of vulnerability or insecurity, of inadequacy, perhaps a fear of failure, a fear of the unknown. These are flavors that I've seen under doubt for myself. So look for yourself. If you notice those kinds of thoughts, what's going on? Check in. Doubt is nourished by unawareness. Doubt is nourished by ignorance. As soon as we even recognize, oh, this is doubt, doubt begins to weaken. Because doubt cannot stand up to the light of mindfulness. And sometimes it can be surprising. On one retreat, I was caught by doubt for quite a long time, a couple hours. And was just, you know, I was like, I should go home. I should give up this practice. I obviously can't do this. And then at some point, it's like, oh, doubt is happening. And the question arose, well, what does doubt feel like? And as soon as I asked that question, I had this tremendous feeling of grief. Like, oh, well, doubt feels like grief. And grief is not really doubt. Grief is grief. And I was just with the grief and aware of the grief, and there was no room for doubt. Doubt wasn't in the picture at that point because the mind was knowing grief. And the feelings of grief kind of lived their life, and I don't know what happened next. Something happened next. Sometimes doubt can be intellectual. I mean, often it does have this quality of some kind of emotional tone underneath, but sometimes it is intellectual. We have this sense of wanting to know something's going to work before we engage in it. Trying to figure out, how is this going to work? How can this possibly work? I mean, when I first heard about this practice, you know, pay attention to your anger rather than acting on it. My first thought was, how's that going to do any good? I couldn't fathom how being mindful of anger would serve the mind at all. And yet, I was willing to suspend my disbelief and try, explore. And so if you do find a kind of an intellectual doubt, a wanting to know how it's going to work, the only way we're going to figure out or see how it works is by the engagement. We have to run the experiment. And so if you can suspend for even just a few moments that sense of intellectual questioning for the willingness to try and see, come and see, what I've seen is the Dharma is good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. It does show us its value if we're willing to engage. So these exploration of these hindrances in spite of the term, you know, hindrance. It's not that we have to somehow, if we see these energies arising, it's not that we that the practice has to wait. I used to think that, you know, I would hear the teachers give the hindrance talk, and I'd say, well, yeah, they're saying that to make me feel better. You know, I know that really the where the action is when there's no hindrances and I'm completely concentrated and, you know, I can see things really clearly. That's where I'll get enlightened. That's where the wisdom will grow. And so it's kind of like, I thought it was a lesser practice when there were hindrances arising. It's kind of like, okay, hindrances are happening. Yes, they say I have to pay. Okay, I'll do this. But I know really that the practice has to wait until, you know, this stuff gets gone. And yet, even with that belief, I actually ended up discovering that lo and behold, in the very midst of being willing to meet these difficult states, very, very profound insights and openings can happen. These hindrances with this curious mindfulness are not in the way of practice. They are the practice. They are our path when they are arising. It really does not matter what is arising as long as we have this curious stance. We can be mindful of anger, and we can be mindful of joy. We can be mindful of a pain in the knee, and we can be mindful of the smell of tofu. It doesn't matter. The continuity of the mindfulness opening to what is here with this curious stance begins to reveal the truth of any experience. Its impermanent, unreliable, unsatisfactory nature. And that begins to undercut the way that we cling, the way that we lean into, the way that we think, oh, I need to have that. I need to get rid of that. As we see the impermanent, unreliable nature of experience, the mind begins to recognize it's not worth clinging. And the mind begins to naturally let go. This I hope that this can encourage you to just be curious about whatever is happening. Fear is like this. Confusion is like this. Bliss is like this. Sights are like this. So let's just sit for a moment.